the Brabson Foundation. Today's program was prepared by Sue Ann Zollinger with help from Jeffrey Conrad in anthropology. I'm Yael Cassander.
In sports, Greg Norman, Joey Sindelar, and Dan Forsman each shot 6 under 66, tying for the early lead at the U.S. Senior Open at the Crooked Stick Golf Course in a suburb of Indianapolis, Indiana, today. The Chicago Cubs are wrapping up a homestand this afternoon against the Houston Astros. The Cubs have won 5 of 6 at Wrigley Field and 10 of 13 since the All-Star break. The game currently in the third inning, in the bottom of the third. Here's the score. The Chicago Cubs 9, Houston 3. The St. Louis Cardinals are looking for a sweep of the Los Angeles Dodgers in tonight's series finale. The Cardinals are 11-2 against the Dodgers at four-year-old Busch Stadium. They lead Chicago by one half game in the NL Central. And the New York Yankees come into U.S. Cellular Field tonight to begin a four-game series with the Chicago White Sox. The Sox will try to turn their fortunes around after a 1-6 road trip. That's sports.
Today's programming is made possible in part by Ratio Architects, designer of the Carle Foundation's Echo Building, on the web at ratioarchitects.com.
If you're house hunting, looking for a bargain in this market, and you have an extra $15 million or so to spare, there's a home for you in L.A., known as the Ennis House. It's an architectural masterpiece designed by Frank Lloyd Wright, and like a lot of old houses, it needs a little work. NPR's Karen Grigsby Bates reports.
Drive past the grime and glitz of Hollywood towards the hills of Griffith Park, and suddenly, there it is, a Mayan temple perched above the city. Ennis House is one of architect Frank Lloyd Wright's most famous creations, and not only to architecture buffs. The house has starred in several movies, from 50s horror flicks to thrillers like Day of the Locust in the 1970s. It featured prominently in an 80s cult film. ...1982's futuristic classic Blade Runner was set in 2019 Los Angeles. Here, bounty hunter Rick Deckard, played by a young Harrison Ford, argues with an android beauty played by Sean Young just outside the house's chauffeur's quarters.
I don't know why he told you what he did.
Talk to him.
He wouldn't see me.
Ennis House was the darkly elegant residence of the head of Tokyo's Yakuza, or mob, in Black Rain, starring Michael Douglas.
You have no part in this.
I am the solution to your problems.
Actually, it was rain that did extensive damage to the house's distinctive cast concrete block exterior. Linda Dishman, executive director of the Los Angeles Conservancy and an Ennis House Foundation board member, explains what happened.
When the rains of 2004 and 2005 came, there was substantial damage from the motor court. So it looked like the house was falling down the hill because the blocks had totally tumbled.
So the house that starred in movies got what a lot of movie stars here get, a facelift. A few years and several million dollars later, it's been partially restored. And now it's for sale. The three nonprofit agencies that oversee the house agree that maintaining it is a financial challenge. Linda Dishman believes the house needs a buyer with deep pockets and the passion to own an architectural gem.
What this house offers is it's a trophy property. Some people have trophy wives. This is a trophy house.
The deep pockets have already been calling, says Aaron Kerman. He's a Beverly Hills realtor who deals in pricey, architecturally significant properties.
It seems that the majority of the people that are looking are people that have multiple homes in different cities, more or less all over the world.
The house has only been on the market for a short while, but Kerman says they'll wait to find exactly the right buyer. It's easier to understand why all the avid interest if you visit Ennis House. The outside, with its high walls and sharp edges, is definitely dramatic, but it's the inside that takes visitors' breath away. Jim DeMayo is Ennis House Foundation's president. He takes me through. As he unlocks the door, DeMayo has one instruction.
Get ready to be dazzled.
Enter the low, dim foyer and take a short flight of steps up to the living room, and all of a sudden you're in this explosion of space and light. The ceiling soars several stories. Beautiful windows with stained glass flourishes give a panoramic view of the city. The oak floors glow deep russet. The brass lighting fixtures gleam. The large windows bring the outdoors in, a Wright signature, and also provide something Wright houses are not famous for, Jim DeMeo.
Yeah, that's one of the primary distinguishing features of the Ennis House. When people come in, they're just really floored by the amount of light, and it really captures the beautiful Southern California sunlight at different parts of the day.
Throughout the house, there are the constant little visual surprises that Wright loved. Variations in height, a window placed where one normally wouldn't be, the luxury of scarlet bathroom walls as a counterpoint to the sober elegance of wood and stone. All this has held up for over 80 years. Jim DeMeo says the architect predicted this just after he finished Ennis House in 1924.
He said, you know, 100 years from now, people are going to remember this house as being literally, you know, the temple on the hill, and they'll make pilgrimages to this structure, and it's very much true today.
Recently, some of the pilgrims have also been prospective buyers, and one may add a new chapter to Ennis House's long history. Karen Grigsby Bates, NPR News.
The internet business world is buzzing about the new internet search alliance between Microsoft and Yahoo. Under the deal, Yahoo will use Microsoft's search engine instead of its own, and Yahoo says the deal will increase its profitability. Analysts, they're not so sure. NPR's Laura Seidel reports.
In the young world of internet businesses, Yahoo is one of the oldest companies. It remains one of the most popular sites on the web and offers an array of services: email, finances, IM, Flickr, maps. Yahoo CEO Carol Bartz told NPR the company will put even more energy into making their services better now that search technology is in someone else's hands.
So it allows Yahoo to really focus on having even better online experience through our homepage and finance, sports, etc., and still have our customers enjoy the search experience.
The search experience will be powered by Microsoft's new search technology called Bing. The two companies signed a 10-year pact. Yahoo's Salesforce will sell all the ads and get 88% of the revenue. Last year, Microsoft tried to buy Yahoo for more than $47 billion. Yahoo rebuffed the offer to the displeasure of many of its shareholders. In the new deal, Microsoft isn't offering up any cash, and Yahoo stocks went down after the announcement. But CEO Bartz says in the long run, Yahoo will have more funds to grow.
Yahoo does not need cash. We have plenty of cash. We just want to have operating leverage, which is what we get through revenue.
I believe Yahoo committed seppuku today. I mean, they basically took the sword, stuck it into their stomach, and cut themselves open.
Jason Calacanis runs Mahalo, a company that combines search and social networking. Calacanis thinks search is going to continue to be the biggest moneymaker on the web, and Yahoo should not be sharing its success with Microsoft. Yahoo's search engine was number two behind Google with 20% of the market, and Microsoft has only about 8%.
Search is an unprecedented opportunity for advertising. When you do a search, you make a gesture. You type a word into a box, whether that word is Toyota Prius or a pizza in Santa Monica. You've basically told the advertising engine what you want.
Calacanis thinks that Microsoft is the big winner because its search engine is going to grow by association with Yahoo's popular web properties. In fact, Google got its original boost by being Yahoo's search engine. Microsoft's search engine, Bing, was unveiled recently to relatively good reviews, and the company's been willing to spend a lot of its capital on research and development to get ahead of Google and Yahoo. Alan Weiner, an analyst with Gartner, a technology research firm, thinks Yahoo made the right move.
Even if they're still ahead in market share, they would need to spend a lot of money in R&D to keep up to where Microsoft was going to be in search and where Google is the market leader.
Weiner believes that when the market bounces back, online banner advertising for Yahoo's online services will start to bring in considerable revenue. However, he agrees that Yahoo may ultimately become a much smaller company. Yahoo officials say users won't see any change for another 2 years. The Justice Department will have to investigate the deal for antitrust violations. If the deal goes through, the joint operation will have about 30% of the search market. And everyone agrees that a merged Yahoo-Microsoft search engine will be much more appealing to advertisers. Laura Seidel, NPR News, San Francisco.
The first offshore wind power project expected to go online is in Nantucket Sound near the Cape Cod, Massachusetts resort area. Some of the residents of the region do not want 130 wind turbines ruining their view. Lester Graham talked with the CEO of the Cape Wind Project, Jim Gordon, about why the wind farm couldn't have been installed over the horizon and out of sight.
Well, first of all, hopefully in the next 10, 15, or 20 years, we'll be able to bring wind turbines further offshore, and they'll be commercially and technically viable. But right now, if you look at the offshore wind farms in Europe that are commercially and technically viable, those projects are being built in nearer shore, shallow waters, lower wave regimes. So it's really what's driving the selection of the Cape Wind site is that it has some of the best wind resources on the East Coast. It is outside of the shipping channels, ferry lines, and air flight paths. It has a reasonable proximity to bring the transmission line to the shore, and it has shallow depths and a low wave height. And with all of this, it's 13 miles from Nantucket, 9 miles from Edgartown on Martha's Vineyard, and 6 miles from Hyannis. So if one were to go to the nearest beach and look out on the horizon, it would have to be a very clear day for you to make out tiny specks on the horizon. People want this project built because they recognize that our energy security, climate change, sustainable economic development, the clean energy jobs that go with a project like this are important, and that we have to live with trade-offs if we're going to transition to a more sustainable energy future.
I wonder what you think of the irony of the Kennedys, who have been so active on the environmental front, fighting your proposal.
You know, I have a lot of respect for Senator Kennedy, and our hope is that the more he reads about Cape Wind and the more he looks at and his staff look at the final environmental impact statement from the federal government that was extremely positive, as well as the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. I mean, I'm hoping that the more Senator Kennedy thinks about this project and looks at how it is going to address the urgent energy, environmental, and economic challenges facing Massachusetts and the region, you know, I'm hoping that he will come around and support the project.
How do you think what happens with your project will affect other offshore proposals?
I think this project is going to set a important precedent. If a project like Cape Wind, which has run this exhaustive regulatory gauntlet and, you know, has shown that the public is in favor of it and that it's passed muster, if this project is not approved, I think it's going to set a terrible precedent. I think that other developers that are looking at moving away from coal or some of the fossil fuels to tap our abundant offshore wind resources, I think they'll have some real second thoughts about investing the enormous amount of time and resources that it takes to get one of these projects in the water.
Jim Gordon is the president of Cape Wind, the offshore wind project proposed to be built near Nantucket. Thanks for your time.
Thank you, Lester.
Jim Gordon spoke with Lester Graham of the Environment Report. Coming up this afternoon on The World from PRI, China's communist leaders do not recognize the Vatican, but the Vatican recognizes many of China's government-controlled bishops. Now it wants all of China's Catholics, including dissidents, to reconcile in one church. That story from Beijing and the day's news coming up today on The World at 3 o'clock. Commentator Amy Guida has been keeping an eye out for Amber Alerts this summer, noting when they go into effect. She says it's silly to wait and that the law seems to agree with her. Here's this week's edition of Legal Issues in the News.
Three young girls all disappeared within the past few months. A 5-year-old from Michigan was found dead in the dirt alongside a river. An 8-year-old from California was found murdered, her body stuffed inside a suitcase. And as I write this, a 10-year-old from Washington State has been missing since late June. The three cases are separated by many miles, but they have at least one thing in common. Not one had what I'd consider an immediate Amber Alert. The Michigan alert came earliest, a few hours after the likely abduction in the wee hours of the morning. The California alert came a few days after the girl went missing, and there was never an official Amber Alert for the Washington girl. Yet circumstances seemed suspicious from the beginning in each case. The little girl from Michigan disappeared while playing outside. The California girl was last seen on security footage skipping happily past her house. And the little girl from Washington disappeared while walking several blocks home from a friend's house at dusk. In each case, abduction seemed probable, at least to some. In both the West Coast cases, early posts on the internet questioned why the authorities had yet to issue an Amber Alert. Amber Alerts are a way to get information out about a probable child abduction in the area. Those of us who have weather radios, for example, hear a warning sound, followed by information about the missing child and the alleged abduction. Drivers may see electronic signs along the highway. Amber Alerts are named after a little girl from Texas found murdered 13 years ago. The U.S. Code of Federal Regulations lists the criteria for an Amber Alert. 1, police believe an abduction occurred. 2, the missing child is 17 or younger. 3, police believe the child is in great danger. 4, enough descriptive information exists so that a public broadcast will help. And 5, the missing child has been entered into a national computer database. It's often the fourth that causes police to hesitate. The argument goes that without descriptive information about a suspect or a suspect vehicle, no abduction can be proved and the information won't be helpful to the search. And yet, how many times does a 5-year-old wander off on her own for hours? When does a 10-year-old who's afraid of the dark go exploring in the dark? And how often does an 8-year-old run away from home? Even if kids who turn up missing did in fact wander off, wouldn't we want to try to find them? Many states have an Amber Alert-like program for missing adults with diminished mental capacity. There's no abduction in those situations, no suspect information, but details of the missing person are broadcast to the public. Besides, the feds give broad discretion to those authorities closer to the action, and the Justice Department repeatedly maintains that its Amber Alert guidelines are guidelines only. Sure, they also recognize that there's a danger in overdoing Amber Alerts, a fear that the public will lose interest, but the danger of that doesn't seem so great when there's a child out there someplace. We'll never know what might have been had Amber Alerts been issued earlier in the recent missing child cases. But if a description of the missing child is all we have, it's the best we can do, and it seems silly to wait to do it. Many more will keep their eyes open for something odd that seems odd only in context. I'm Amy Guida.
Amy Guida is an assistant professor of journalism and law at the University of Illinois.
Earth and Sky.
Thursday, July 30th, 2009. There's a bright star right next to tonight's waxing gibbous moon.
It's Antares.